The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Heart Letter. And then from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first thing I'm going to do is to finish the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2024 by reading an article that's entitled Travel Tips for People with Heart-Related Risks. Follow this advice before, during, and after your flight, especially when it's time to order a drink. If you're planning to travel by plane over the holidays or for a winter vacation, a little extra preparation may be wise if you have or are at risk for heart disease. For most people, the simple precautions described below will suffice. But check with your doctor before booking a flight if you've recently had a heart attack or undergone any type of heart procedure. Before you take off, write down the phone numbers for your primary care doctor and your cardiologist, if applicable, on a card or in a small notebook, just in case your cell phone dies. Include your current medical conditions and a list of your prescriptions, which you'll need in the event of an emergency. Keep all of your prescription medications easily accessible in your carry-on bag, and make sure to bring extra doses in case of travel delays, says Dr. Yulia Mintz, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital. It's safer and in many states and countries required to leave them in the original labeled container. Make note of any time differences between your home and destination. Ideally, you should stick to a consistent schedule and take your medications based on your home time zone, says Dr. Mintz. Set an alarm on your phone or watch as a reminder, she suggests. At the airport, the full-body scans commonly used for security screening are safe for people with pacemakers or implantable cardioverter defibrillators. But these devices may trigger alarms on walk-through metal detectors, which are used in certain circumstances. Carry the ID card for your device in case you need to show it to security personnel, says Dr. Mintz. In the air. When the flight attendant offers up drinks, resist the temptation to order an alcoholic beverage. Even on the ground, drinking alcohol can raise the risk of atrial fibrillation and high blood pressure. But in-flight drinking may pose additional dangers, particularly for people prone to cardiovascular disease, according to a study published online in June 2024 by the journal Thorax. For the study, researchers randomly assigned 48 healthy adults to spend 2 nights sleeping at normal air pressure or at the equivalent of airplane cabin pressure. The participants stayed sober for 1 night, but drank alcohol, the equivalent of 2 beers or 2 glasses of wine, the other night. They also wore devices measuring their blood oxygen and heart rate. Compared to people sleeping in normal air pressure, those sleeping in airplane cabin pressure had lower blood oxygen levels and higher heart rates. Adding alcohol to the mix lowered oxygen levels even more and boosted heart rates even higher. Such changes could be dangerous for older adults at risk for heart problems. But do drink plenty of water, which has the added advantage of requiring you to get up to use the restroom. On a long flight, walking a little every hour will help improve circulation in your legs. So can flexing your feet and circling your ankles. Doing so may reduce the chance of developing a blood clot, although the overall risk of such a clot, called a DVT, is quite low. Doctors often recommend that people with a history of DVT wear compression stockings when they fly. If your vacation involves more activity than you're accustomed to doing regularly, take it easy the first day or so. That's especially important if you travel to a high elevation destination like a ski resort. The higher the altitude, the less oxygen in the air. In response, your heart rate and blood pressure rise temporarily until your body adapts to the lower oxygen level, usually in a few days. As a general rule, don't go above 8,000 feet the first day, and give your body time to adapt before going higher or doing any strenuous exercise. Ascending up to 12,000 feet is considered fine for most people with stable heart disease. In the event that you need medical care while away from home, the CDC has helpful information, including resources about locating medical services abroad, and you can find this on the internet at health.harvard.edu/HCDT. Now I'm going to go ahead with the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. This is the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of October 2024. And I'm going to start with an article entitled Sinuses, Many and Mighty. Sinuses measure just millimeters in diameter, but can hit your body and spirit with the force of a jackhammer. Your sinuses are four pairs of air-filled, interconnected cavities located between your eyes and nose. What goes on inside these cavities, a microscopic battle between infection and inflammation causing antigens and the body's defense forces, can have a serious impact on your health and comfort. Every year, about 29 million adults in the United States, or about one out of eight, are diagnosed with an infection in their sinuses, also called sinusitis. One-fifth, in other words, 20%, of all prescribed antibiotics are intended to treat sinusitis. Your sinuses are connected to your external environment through the nasal passages and can be exposed to allergens, viruses, fungi, and bacteria. This can lead to congestion, pain, excess mucus, postnasal drip, and swelling around the area. Because the sinuses are sometimes misunderstood, here are seven important things to know about them. The first thing is, the sinuses make mucus, which flows into your nasal passages to clean and moisturize them. Lining the inside of your sinuses are little hairs that are constantly sweeping the mucus through small openings that drain into your nose and throat. Sinus trouble typically begins when the sinuses become irritated and inflamed, causing sinus tissue to swell. Expansion of tissues can narrow or close off the ostia, making it hard for mucus to drain out of the sinus cavities. Once drainage is blocked, mucus and air pressure build, causing a feeling of stuffiness and congestion. Sinus trouble often starts on one side with the inflamed section painful to the touch and spreads to the other side. The most common cause of sinusitis is the common cold, which is caused by a virus. Most people can typically fight off this infection in 7 to 10 days, and their sinus symptoms resolve. Viral colds sometimes can lead to bacterial sinus infections. The stagnant, moist environment of a blocked sinus cavity gives bacteria a place to thrive. An additional bacterial sinus infection can develop. Other causes of sinusitis include nasal allergies, fungal infections, and exposure to air pollution or cigarette smoke. Most sinus infections get better with rest, time, and home remedies, like nasal sprays, decongestants, and pain relievers. Antibiotics have no effect on viruses, which are the most common cause of sinus infection. Antibiotics would only be considered if a bacterial infection developed. Usually, a bacteria infection diagnosis is not made until 5 to 10 days after the onset of symptoms. Symptoms that mark a bacterial infection might include mucus that is thick and yellow or green in color, a tender area on the face or sinus, mainly on one side of the face, pain that is present in the upper teeth and is worse on one side of the face, and symptoms that last 7 days or more, particularly when they first improve and then worsen. Sinusitis that lasts more than 12 weeks despite medical treatment is called chronic sinusitis. Your headache is most likely not a sinus headache. Migraines and headaches from sinusitis are easy to confuse because the symptoms may overlap. But studies have shown that most people who see their healthcare team for sinus headaches find out they have migraines instead. For both migraines and sinusitis headache, the pain often gets worse when bending forward. Migraines also can be accompanied by various nasal symptoms, including congestion, facial pressure, and a clear, watery nasal discharge. These are due to the autonomic nervous system playing a role in the migraine headache. However, sinusitis usually doesn't come with nausea or vomiting and get worse from noise or bright light. Also, all of these are common features of migraines. The next point is, you're likely to have tools at home that are good for treating sinusitis. In addition to seeing your care team, you can take other steps. You might try to apply heat, either by putting a warm compress on your face or by breathing steam from a pot of hot water or in the shower. Drink plenty of water and other fluids to thin and loosen mucus. Avoid alcohol. Avoid tobacco, which can dry out the sinuses. Use nasal corticosteroid sprays like Flonase Allergy Relief or Rhinocort Allergy or Nasonex 24-hour Allergy. These may speed healing in some with bacterial sinus infections with milder symptoms or with allergies as underlying cause. The sprays are available without a prescription and should be used daily until symptoms go away. Take non-prescription pain relievers like Tylenol. Generally speaking, blocked sinuses do not cause your eyes to water. Tear ducts near your eyes also drain through the nasal cavity, but they use a separate system from your sinuses. Blocked sinuses typically don't cause eye bags or puffiness. Allergies can cause eye puffiness. Talk with your primary care team or an allergist about treatment options. And an ear infection caused by a sinus infection isn't as common as people may think. Most likely, a person develops a head cold, which can cause both an ear infection and a sinus infection. While these infections may occur at the same time, viral rhinitis is the cause. Finally, with chronic sinusitis, a cure usually isn't possible, but symptoms often can be well managed with nasal irrigation. This involves gently squirting or pouring a warm, purified saltwater solution to your nose with a squeeze bottle, bulb syringe, or neti pot. This technique can be very effective. Your care team may recommend adding medication to the irrigation fluid to help fight inflammation or infection. The second thing is nasal corticosteroids. These sprays are used daily to calm sinus inflammation. If the non-prescription options that were mentioned earlier aren't effective, a prescription strength spray may be beneficial. Then there are injected medications. These include Dupixent and Nucala, as well as Xolair, X-O-L-A-I-R. These are injected medications for treating people with chronic sinusitis who have nasal polyps that aren't helped by corticosteroids. Nasal polyps are small, painless growths inside the nose or sinuses that often develop along with chronic sinusitis. Finally, there are allergy treatments. Avoiding allergens, taking an antihistamine medication, and getting allergy shots are options for tackling sinus inflammation due to allergic rhinitis. Now here's a practical article in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter that's called Colon Prep. Colonoscopies probably don't top anyone's list of favorite activities, but the tests, which give your healthcare team a close-up look at your lower digestive tract, play a vital role in preventing and detecting cancer and other serious health concerns. Having regular colonoscopies reduces the risk of dying of cancer of the colon or rectum by 60%. The procedure allows doctors to identify problems like tumors, which can lead to early treatment, or polyps can be found and removed during the procedure, preventing cancer. But in an estimated 25% of colonoscopies, the results aren't reliable because the person having the procedure isn't adequately prepped. This means the colon is not fully clear of residual stool that could interfere with the test. This often prolongs the procedure and results in a decreased ability to detect polyps. And an inadequate prep means you will likely have to undergo the procedure a second time. Preparation for a colonoscopy involves changing your diet in the days leading up to the procedure. You also take a laxative that's intended to empty your digestive tract, so your healthcare team has a clear look at the lining of your colon. Studies have shown that some factors increase the risk of inadequate colon preparation. These factors include being age 65 or older, being overweight, having had prior colon surgery, taking opioids or other pain medications, having chronic constipation, and having diabetes, especially when accompanied by delayed or impaired food processing from the stomach to the small intestine, which is called gastroparesis. There are a range of reasons why these factors affect colonoscopy prep. One reason is they may affect mobility, which makes it harder to get to and from the bathroom. Another is they may slow the digestive tract's response time in processing food and medication. The period leading up to a colonoscopy is generally divided into two parts. Part one is the week before the procedure, when you start changing your diet and potentially changing your medication routine. Part two is a day or so before, when you take the laxative treatment. And here's some details about this. For the week before, to maximize your preparation, avoid red, orange, or purple foods. These can look like blood during the colonoscopy. Ask ahead about taking your regular medication. If you take insulin, ask about special instructions to help prevent your blood sugar from becoming low. If you regularly take antiplatelet drugs like aspirin or Plavix, ask your primary care team if stopping the medication before your test may be worthwhile. Talk with your care team if you take a blood thinner, as these often must be stopped or monitored before a colonoscopy. Stop taking Imodium or loperamide, and also stop oral iron supplements 5 days before the procedure. Also ask your care team at what point to stop taking weight loss drugs like Ozempic, Trulicity, and Mounjaro. Avoid high-fiber foods for 3 to 4 days before your procedure. Whole grain products, legumes, nuts, seeds, raw vegetables, and popcorn are particularly high in fiber. For the day before, consider doing some other things to ensure a complete prep. First of all, stock up on clear liquids. A clear liquid diet is recommended for 24 hours before a colonoscopy. Good choices include water, clear broth, fruit juices that don't have a red coloring, and clear, colorless sodas. Alcoholic drinks are not advised. If you're at risk for constipation, you may be asked to extend the clear liquid diet to 2 days before the procedure. You may find the colon prep solution more drinkable if it's cold. Prepare and refrigerate it according to the instructions. It also may help to drink it through a straw. Suck on a lemon slice or hard candy between sips. Chewing gum between sips also helps for some people. Drinking half the solution the day before the procedure and the other half the day of makes it more tolerable and has been shown to increase the likelihood of a successful test. Your prep may come with specific splitting recommendation. Consider add-ons. If you have risk factors for inadequate colon preparation, your healthcare team may recommend additional medications. For example, your care team may suggest the anti-nausea medication ondansetron or Zofran. People with chronic constipation or a history of inadequate colon prep may benefit from taking an additional non-prescription laxative, magnesium citrate, the morning of the last day before the procedure. In addition, your care team may recommend drinking a clear protein drink the day before the procedure to lessen hunger due to fasting. Now in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, we're going to look at a series of short questions called Second Opinion. And the first question is, I go months without hearing from my brother. He's been much more withdrawn ever since the COVID-19 lockdown. He always tells me he's fine, but should I be worried? There may be something to worry about. Although mental health professionals and government bodies have sought to reduce social stigma around mental health conditions, studies show that men still tend to be reluctant to talk about these conditions or to seek needed help. Women are diagnosed with depression at higher rates than men, but men die by suicide at significantly higher rates than women. The imbalance suggests that depression in men may be more severe or left unidentified. It also highlights a need for more accessible help. Common symptoms of depression include feeling sad, hopeless, or empty, feeling tired, having trouble sleeping or sleeping too much, and not enjoying or stopping activities that once brought pleasure. But men may have more subtle symptoms, including more time spent at work or with other distracting activities, physical symptoms like headache, pain, and digestive issues, drug or alcohol misuse, abusive or controlling behavior, anger or irritation, and risky behaviors. Community-based therapy can be effective for men. Some communities benefit from mental health outreach from leaders in spiritual organizations or local businesses. For example, some rural communities have set up tip lines and have trained people like mechanics and veterinarians who often visit farms to recognize and discuss symptoms of depression. Asking for help can be hard for men, but as shown in the examples, men are more likely to open up to people they've come to trust over the years. Your brother may talk to you first before he'd talk to a healthcare professional. Gently remind him that without treatment, depression isn't likely to go away, and it may get worse. But even if it's severe, depression usually gets better with medication, counseling, or both. Many treatment options exist, including care provided by mobile technology. It's a sign of strength to ask for advice or seek help when you need it. And another brief question. My doctor says that one of my medications is causing low magnesium. What should I know about magnesium supplements? Magnesium is a mineral that is essential to many important processes in the body. Older adults tend to have lower intakes of dietary magnesium, and their bodies often have a harder time absorbing and retaining the magnesium they do consume. Having low magnesium can have numerous health effects. You may experience symptoms like elevated blood pressure, higher blood sugar, headache and muscle cramping, anxiety and trouble sleeping. Over time, not getting enough magnesium has been linked to health conditions like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and osteoporosis. Risk factors for low magnesium include type 2 diabetes, digestive conditions like Crohn's disease and celiac disease, the use of medications like diuretics and proton pump inhibitors, and regular alcohol consumption. Diet's a factor too. The standard American diet can be deficient in magnesium because processed foods are so highly prevalent. Many whole and healthy foods are rich in magnesium, including nuts, beans, seeds, and dark chocolate. It may be difficult to get enough magnesium from food alone. If your body's magnesium stores are low, a supplement may be appropriate. Consider this general advice. Magnesium often causes loose stool, abdominal cramping, and bowel urgency. If you tend to have slow bowel transit, any magnesium supplement should be fine. If you're prone to loose bowel movements, consider magnesium glycinate. The typical dose is 250 to 500 milligrams daily. Don't take magnesium if you have kidney disease, unless it's recommended by your healthcare team. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.